I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As Americans, our minds are occupied minute to minute. Social life, technology, the daily grind. But all those worries can have a real impact on our physical and mental health. Today, how coping with stress can start in its source, the mind. We'll learn how the ancient practice of meditation can help tame our neural pathways. Then, wisdom on a different but equally important topic, romantic relationships. Are the traditional archetypes of family keeping us from being truly happy? We'll speak with one woman who curated stories about the intimacies of marriage and learned a thing or two in the process. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For the past 10 years, the American Psychological Association has commissioned an annual nationwide survey that looks at the state of stress and its impact on this country. What it shows is that we stress out over many things: the political climate, the future of the nation, the economy, violence in many forms, our personal safety. The 2017 report also found an association between the constant use of technology and higher stress levels in Americans. When it comes to how we deal with stress, the top answer from both men and women is exercise or walking. Other methods for coping include going online, watching TV, time with friends or family, reading, praying, and eating. Our next guest offers a different path to dealing with stress and the damage it can cause to our minds and bodies. Preetha G is co-founder of the One World Academy in India. There she and her husband offer guidance that can create a total transformation. The change, they say, starts with oneself. Preetha G will be in Kansas City on Friday to speak at this year's TEDxKC conference. Today she joins us by Skype from Chennai, India. You are 10 and a half hours ahead of us, so I'll say good evening and welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much, Steve. So wonderful to be here.
What was the catalyst that led you and your husband, Krishna, to start One World Academy?
We had an experience. It started off with an accident. We, as a family, met with an accident while we were at the Big Bear Lake in California. Hmm. We emerged safe from the accident, but while in the waters, Krishnaji, my husband, had a powerful insight as to what was keeping people in a state of suffering.
And
what was the reason? Yes?
What was that insight?
While in the waters, he saw that what kept suffering alive for days, months, and years after a painful event was over in anybody's life, he saw that all suffering, all stressful state or unhappiness, he saw it very clearly that it was a preoccupation with oneself. Hmm. It was about love that was withheld from us, about pleasure that was denied us, about opportunities that did not come our way. The entire thinking is only revolving around me, 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 and me. And in that state, we are actually not focused on finding solutions to problems.
Before this, what did each of you do?
We were a part of another spiritual tradition, which was more based on faith. We are used to meditation. We are used to looking into ourselves, into experiencing our inner state. But this one particular experience that he had while in the waters, the cold waters at Big Bear Lake, changed his entire perception and changed my entire perception towards suffering, towards unhappiness, towards stressful states. And we are teaching for the past 8 years, because whatever we teach is a combination. It's a combination of liberative wisdom. It involves processes, powerful processes, and it involves meditation. It involves practices so that people are able to cut through of the suffering states or stressful states. If you look at all of our human, I mean, if you look at our life, basically live in only two states. We either live in a stressful state or we live in a beautiful state or the no stress state. So if you're not living in a beautiful state, that means your default state is stress. So it is so important to bring attention to which state you're living in order to experience life differently.
You know, science is able to show us now that what goes on in our minds will manifest itself on our bodies, and you're saying as much here. When we are stressed, you know, blood pressure rises, we get a headache. In other words, we suffer. One World Academy realizes that if the mind is a source of the suffering, that it can also be the means of reducing it. Do I have that right?
Definitely, Steve. But what we wanted to show is, like, every thinking that happens within us, we are not bringing attention to it. It's the most neglected area of our life. And since we are not bringing enough attention to our inner state, it becomes an emotion. And we live with this emotion, and it becomes our way of living. Your consciousness is used to living in this stressful state. So it's basically an addiction that has happened.
Meditation is an ancient practice, and it's taught at the academy. At its most basic level, what is meditation?
For One World Academy, meditation is about declutching one's habitual emotional thinking because it impacts our state. Negative emotional thinking.
You know, Americans seem to be... go ahead, Preetha Ji.
Yeah, and to live in a beautiful state. It is to declutch from stressful state and to experience a beautiful state.
You know, Americans seem to be, you know, always on the go from the minute we wake up. You know, family, work, social life, all keep our calendars pretty full. I can hear people thinking they're too busy to take time to be still for a few minutes each day and to calm their minds. How can you convince them to just stop and literally just take a few breaths?
Actually, Steve, if you look at the statistics now, it is almost showing that 80% of our thinking is old thinking.
Is what thinking?
So you're only thinking... old thinking. Mm-hmm. That is, your thoughts are repetitive. 80% of it is just repetitive. So in that state of like having the same thought again and again, there is no creativity, there is no intelligence. There is nothing that you're bringing to life.
Hmm.
Were you able to get it?
Yes. And the irony... Yes.
It's like just the old thinking that goes on and on and on because we have not brought attention to ourselves. So if it's not 80% old and it's going to be 80% new, imagine the creative outburst that we can have.
That's interesting. You know, the irony I see here is that Americans can also be so self-absorbed, which you've mentioned here. So you wouldn't think we'd welcome a chance to focus on ourselves, but we don't, at least in an introspective way. The Academy's Field of Transcendence course has an interesting description that includes transcend I consciousness, experience one consciousness. Give us a sense of what the difference is between the two.
When we talk about I consciousness, Steve, it is a state in which you feel extremely limited. It is a state where you feel you're actually separate from the rest. It is a very painful state where thinking is old, where thinking is preoccupied around yourself. While the state of one consciousness is a state of expansion, it is a state of love, it is a state of great inner peace, where you feel totally connected to the world around us. It is like expanding your consciousness, where you're not limited, but you feel so expanded, you feel so connected. And that state of connection is an amazing state. You feel so joyful. You see, living life feels like a beautiful experience. It is not a painful and a stressful experience.
Hmm.
So we transcend from I consciousness into experiencing one consciousness, the field of transcendence.
This is Up to Date on KCUR's 89.3. I'm talking with Preetha G. of the One World Academy. Preetha is one of the presenters at Friday's TEDxKC conference. For information on how you can view that event, go to TEDxKC.org. Preetha, you create meditations for the coursework at the Academy. What are the various elements of meditation?
When we started creating meditations in the Academy, we were focused on trying to help everyone out. We saw a few meditations work for few people, a few not working for few people. So our intention was to make sure we have meditations that would work for everybody. So we have included, if you have three major categories, we would say we have concentration-based meditation, we have flow-based meditation, and we have meditation as a happening where you have an experience, an explosive experience, say an explosive experience of bliss. So concentration-based meditation is trying to focus on one single thing and take away everything else out of their mind. That helps in moving into a state of calm. It helps in moving into a state of peace. Then we have the flow-based meditation where we involve movement, where we involve breath, and where you start experiencing your inner world. For us, the focus is the inner world. We feel that is the core. So we start bringing attention to our thinking. We start bringing attention to our emotions and just witness. We're not trying to reform or change here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have meditation as a happening, which is more focused on having a transcendental experience where you move beyond yourself into experiencing the universe. It's a mystical element.
Is there one type of meditation that is believed to be the most effective?
It depends upon the seekers or the person who comes to us, the participant's enthusiasm and his seeking to just move out of a stressful state or a suffering state. So it fully depends upon the person, on the participant who come to us.
What's the hardest part of meditation, as far as you're concerned?
It'll be difficult for anybody who's just starting. In the sense, I wouldn't say it is not possible. What I would say is, when we're starting to ride a bike, it takes a few falls, it takes a few a little bit amount of practice before you become a pro at it. So it is about practice. And it is simple, and at the Academy, we make sure it is possible for everybody to meditate.
You know, visitors to the Academy's website can actually practice the Great Soul Sync, where you lead them through a meditation that lasts about 16 minutes. Our producer tried it and liked it, and she said she could have gone longer so because it was so calming. How long can a meditation last, and does that really matter in the end?
If you're able to meditate for longer, it definitely helps. But you can start off by meditating even for 3 minutes, or even focusing for three small breaths. It makes a huge difference. It calms your mind. And seeing how it is actually impacting your consciousness, then you take it up. You do more of it. Because you start enjoying it. You know it has a direct impact on your experience of life. You have a direct impact on the way you relate to people. So you start doing more of it. But not that we're going to sit down and meditate all our life. So, well, yeah, how much of us need it for you?
Our producer, Danny Alexander, who tried this, is nodding her head vigorously here as you say that. In one of the videos on the website, your husband, Krishna, speaks about the vision of One World Academy to bring about a new consciousness in you that is a state of great wisdom, great peace, and great compassion. That's a very powerful message. Do people who come to the Academy have different ideas of what that means or what it can do for them?
We have people coming from different walks of life, Steve. We have people who just want to experience meditation. We have people who want to, like, have a great quest in finding out about the secrets of this universe. We have people coming to us want to experience greater love in their life, greater wonderful relationships in their life. We have people coming to us who want to become a great parent. It's very interesting to see when they do come. It's amazing to see that the different reasons for which they've come.
Besides the meditation, the Academy has yoga, sacred breathing practices, and wisdom teachings. Can you tell us a little bit about the wisdom teachings and what they're based on?
Wisdom teachings are based on the experience of our life, Krishnaji's and my life. And it is basically from, if we get back to that accident that we had, though it lasted only for a few minutes, I think his thinking was so clear in that. He was able to see that there was a choice left in front of him. One is a choice of freedom, or the second one is a choice of comfort. Like we try to hold on to a few beliefs, try to understand why it has happened to us, but we try to reinforce this thinking again and again. But fear comes, suffering comes, because it is not appeasing our fear. It is not appeasing our suffering. Our logical reasoning, whether it belongs to this world or other world. But when it comes to the choice of freedom, we have a greater choice in terms of experiencing ourselves, looking into the truth of us, and breaking through the preoccupation with ourselves and experiencing a state of expansion. So this entire experience that we had in the waters during the accident is what has translated as One World Academy. And it clearly shows a path towards liberation. It clearly shows path towards freedom.
You know, I can...
And, yes.
Well, there's a sense of a ripple effect taking place here, Preethaji. I mean, those who experience the teachings of the Academy, you know, they wind up reflecting that in their everyday life, which consciously or subconsciously registers with the people they interact with and so on. But it all begins with the individual and not with a group of people, right?
Definitely. Even a small stone can change the course of a river, Steve. So, and we believe in an individual's transformation. We don't believe in reformation. We don't believe in trying to change one's behavior, trying to change one's attitude, trying to change one's actions. But we want to go at the core of it. We want to transform one's consciousness. Whether you're feeling separate from the world or whether you're feeling connected to the world. So this journey is from moving from separation into experiencing connection. It is a journey from moving from stressful state into experiencing a beautiful state.
Well, Preethaji, you have
and
such a beautiful...
And actually impacts people around you. Because from a beautiful state, you can only create more wonderful things for yourself, more wonderful things for the people around you.
Well, Preethaji, you have such a beautiful voice, and I've calmed down considerably just doing this interview with you. It's been a pleasure to hear you talk to us.
Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you so much for having me here.
Preethaji joined us via Skype. She's co-founder of the One World Academy near Chennai, India. Preetha is one of the presenters at this Friday's TEDxKC conference. For more information on the event, go to TEDxKC.org. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about marriage and relationships and all kinds of good stuff. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we discussed with two county legislators ways to improve the Jackson County Jail and learned how technology can help journalists tell more immersive stories. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we get a fresh perspective on criminal justice reform. Also, we look at the state of organized labor in Missouri. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Now on to a different type of wisdom, the type that's too often hard-won and painful, but nonetheless valuable for what we learn in the process. It's what our romantic relationships teach us. Kathy Hanauer is a New York Times bestselling author of, among other things, two essay anthologies. The first, The Bitch in the House, was published in 2002 and described as the sound at the collective voice of successful women today in all their anger, grace, and glory. The follow-up to that collection, The Bitch is Back, Older, Wiser, and Getting Happier, came out in 2016 and was chosen as NPR's best book that year. It offers female perspectives that occur with the passage of time. In 2004, Hanauer and her husband, Daniel Jones, founded the New York Times Modern Love column, which Dan has edited since then. Kathy Hanauer will be in town on Friday for TEDxKC, and she joins us from the studios of New England Public Radio. Kathy, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
What was the inspiration for that first anthology, The Bitch in the House?
I think at the time I was a working mother with a young child and young children eventually, and I was seeing a lot of women around me who had been used to having full-time jobs for a long time and suddenly became mothers and realized that combining the two was not quite what they had expected. So they were feeling angry or betrayed. And I just decided to put those voices together and create a book about it.
Well, that's such an enormous transition, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. Especially for my generation, where we grew up really thinking that we'd be able to, I hate this expression, but have it all.
Yes, of course.
You know, we thought it would be easy or easier to combine ambitious careers, sometimes where we were making the bulk of the income in our family, with motherhood, and we found that that wasn't always the case.
The subtitle of the book is 26 Women Tell the Truth About Sex, Solitude, Work, Motherhood, and Marriage, and they do so in a very hold-nothing-back kind of way. I don't think I could write that openly about my relationship with my wife, which is why I stick to politics, I think. How did you get these women to participate in the book, or did it take much convincing?
It's funny you say that, because I think women are better at this than men in a certain way. I was a novelist, and I am a novelist, and so I had a lot of friends who were writers. I also had been a magazine editor and magazine writer, and I was living in New York at the time. And so I had a lot of friends who were sort of going through the same thing I was and eager to write about it and vent about it. And I started by asking people I knew and then moved on to writers I knew that I admired or who had written about the topic or who could cover a topic I wanted in the book that I didn't know somebody who could fit the bill.
Did you have to convince them?
Believe it or not, in most cases I didn't. I mean, I think among my friends who were writers and novelists, they were hungry to write about this and talk about this. And that's what we writers do. we write it down and try to figure it out. So they were angry. A lot of them were angry. So they wanted to do it, and I felt like I was hitting on something, which is why I felt very lucky to have sort of found that topic when I did. But the hard ones at that time were the more well-known writers, because I was not well-known at that time, and I had to do some chasing. But in the end, it was a great experience. The whole book was so much fun to do.
You know, there's dating, dumping, married men, marriage, divorce, have kids, don't have kids. How are you able to ensure the variety of experiences that you wind up getting here?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess, I tried for an age range for one. In the first book, in The Bitch in the House, which I now call Bitch One, the age range is 25 or 27 to 72. And I really wanted, the second part is called Look at Me Now. Or the final part is called that. Because that's sort of looking back on the mistakes you made and how it feels now. And the second book, The Bitch is Back, the one that's just coming out in paperback this fall, or in a couple weeks actually, is more that. It's more the middle age looking back. But I thought that in The Bitch in the House, by starting with a young woman who wasn't married yet and what does she want, what is she looking for, that I could cover a range of experiences. But I also looked a little bit like I wanted an essay about being overweight, because that's such a tricky topic for women. And I found this beautiful writer named Natalie Kush, who I didn't meet and haven't spoken to since, but she did a gorgeous essay. It's a little bit of an outlier in The Bitch in the House, but it was one that I really wanted in there. So I don't know. I just tried to sit down and think, what would I want to read mm-hmm. if I were reading a book like this?
Well, what's it like editing 26 different writers, and how did you do it?
Yeah, it's a different experience with each writer. So I've done two anthologies, and my husband, Dan, did the companion volume to The Bitch in the House, which is called The Bastard on the Couch.
I was going to ask you. Yeah,
the two of us together edited quite a few essays between those two books. And, you know, there are also some that you assign that don't come through the way you want to. So I think with each piece, you just approach it differently and see what the writer's like, what their strengths are, weaknesses. And it's just, you never know what you're going to get. But all in all, almost all of them turned out great.
Now, this is what I wanted to get to here, Kathy, because there's a lot of anger and resentment in the first book of essays. I mean, women who felt their partners weren't carrying a fair share of the load, or either emotionally or in daily life, it would come out as criticism, sarcasm, or nagging. That didn't surprise me. What did surprise me was realizing just how much they held back the total fury of what they were feeling. Was that surprising or alarming to you to see that and to read that?
To feel that they were so angry?
Yes, and holding back so much.
You know, it wasn't because that's what made me do the book. Just listening to woman after woman after woman say, I'm so mad. You know, I come home from work and we're supposed to be splitting this. And I don't necessarily think it was men's fault. I just think that there was something. Many of us had grown up with stay-at-home moms or mothers like my mother, who was home when I was young, at least, and putting meals on the table. And that was our role model. We thought it was going to be different. But our husbands had grown up in those same families, too. Not all, always, but in the middle-class suburbs where I grew up. You know, a lot of us were conflicted that we weren't able to do what our mothers were doing and angry that our husbands were sticking more to the script of their fathers. And they just didn't know. They didn't know that when the laundry basket is full, you have to put a load of laundry in. And if we said, honey, can you put a load of laundry in, they would do it. But if we didn't say it, they wouldn't. And that was making us mad.
You're striking close to home here, Kathy. Be careful here. You know, for folks who think there should be a male equivalent to the book, you've already alluded to this. It's called The Bastard on the Couch. Tell our listeners who pulled that collection together here.
Well, it's funny. After we did the women, I was really thinking we need the male response to this. And my best friend, who's in both of my bitch books, Kate Christensen, she's a novelist. She and I were talking a lot about this. And we were thinking about it. And then we thought, And then we sort of teamed up with my husband's agent in a way. Not teamed up, but just sort of thought it hit all of us at the same time that he was the one who should do the male response. And he was game. He was very he took a hit for the team with this whole project. It worked out well in the end, I think. But he had fun, too, and he gathered the men. And one of the things I found that was different in the two anthologies that was really interesting and striking is that men were not angry, with few exceptions. They weren't angry. They were more willing to use humor and self-deprecation and to say, yeah, she's right. You know, she's the better person. And I'm just like this big boy, you know, who's just trying to get through. They weren't as likely to trash their wives as we were to trash our husbands. I think men are just more low-key in general.
Well, low-key, or I'm wondering if they're more reticent to be open and honest about their feelings in a
exactly.
way that women are.
Exactly. I mean, the subtitle of The Bastard on the Couch was 27 Men Try Really Hard to Explain Their Feelings About Love, Loss, Fatherhood, and Freedom. I just don't think they were as worked up about it all, and they don't – I don't want to stereotype because I know there are exceptions on both sides, but I don't think they – they weren't as angry, so they weren't thinking about it as much. They were just trying to muddle through and do, you know, my husband used to say, you know, I'll do whatever you want. I just don't want you to be mad at me.
You know, I think I've used that line before. I think that really rings a bell. You know, yeah, it's just all about survival, I think, sometimes, you know. Kathy Hanauer is our guest. She's the New York Times bestselling author of The Bitch in the House and its follow-up collection, The Bitch is Back, Older, Wiser, and Getting Happier. That's now out in paperback, Kathy just said. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 here, or again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. By the way, what did Dan think of Bitch in the House, your first book?
You know, he was very supportive. I mean, we've always been very supportive of each other work-wise. And I just think he thought the whole thing was a kick. There were times when I think he was sort of like, wait a minute. But for the most part, he's always supported my projects. And he was very helpful. He looked at the pieces. He helped me edit some of them. You know, we worked together a lot, and we always have. Now we don't really have time so much because he's so busy with Modern Love. But we even launched Modern Love together before he took it over very early on.
The column in the New York Times, yeah.
Yes, but he was supportive and helped me and was really great about the whole thing.
If our listeners just happen to be women and they're holding back all kinds of fury about their spouses, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You told our producer before this conversation, Kathy, we can have it all, we just can't have it all perfectly. How long did it take you to gain that piece of wisdom here?
That's a good question. Maybe I'm still gaining that piece of wisdom. But I think, you know, I've thought a lot writing this TED Talk about what advice I would give. And I think in the end, that's one of the things. I mean, I think one thing is to go in with a different expectation than I did. I was so naive about it. And I don't know why I would have been, because I was the oldest of four kids, and I knew what it was like to take care of a baby. But I think I just didn't have the expectation. I didn't have enough help. I didn't have enough friends who were in my position. It was much easier with the second child. So one is about expectation, but another thing is just about letting some things go if you can. You know, I was always kind of perfectionistic about my work, and that's a hard thing to be. I think people that are less ambitious, less perfectionist, might have an easier time. Somebody who can let her house be a mess, who can not write a thank you note for every gift, you know, who's just not so compulsive and firstborn. I'm a firstborn, so that's sometimes. Go ahead.
Just hearing you talk about this, it just strikes me that there ought to be classes for couples as they have their first kid and they move and their relationship changes from one focused on each other to one focused on a new baby and what that means. And because there's all this shared experience out there that seems to be going wasted in some cases. You know, your book helps and other books help. But boy, I mean, a lot of folks, you're right, walk into this, they're too busy to read books and they don't know what they're heading into here.
You know, I love that you said that, because one of the things, if the talk could have been 28 minutes instead of 18, one of the things I really would have loved to put in, and actually this was suggested by Mike Lundgren, the man who's running the whole
right,
TED Talk series.
Right, here in Kansas City, yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing. But he said, instead of Lamaze, they should have La Life.
yeah.
He was responding to something I said, and it's so true. I took a birthing class with my husband and with other couples that were pregnant. And it was something like 8 weeks and 2 hours a night about giving birth. And I think seven of the eight of us ended up with C-sections.
Wow.
Whereas I think if I could redesign that class, it would be one class devoted to birthing and labor and the other seven devoted to what do you do with how does it work after the baby's born? You know,
yes.
Breast infections. So many women get breast infections or have trouble nursing. How do you deal with that? And who do you call for help? And or how do you shop for groceries when you're home with a baby and you're working? Or how do you?
Well, how do you divide the labor between you and your spouse? You
exactly.
know, and how is this going to work really once things get real and the baby's waking up at 3 a.m? You know, it's that
exactly.
kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be a very smart. I wish I could have taken a course like that. I should have.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Jessica from Kansas City, Missouri. Jessica, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. So, married very late in life, had a child at 43. Very difficult to help motivate or mold my partner into being a responsible yet energetic. So both of us, you know, having a brand new baby. We both have responsibilities. I think in the beginning, it was like most of the responsibility was placed on me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like more laundry, dishes, everything, you know, dog, new kid. And it was always difficult to get my partner to get up with the baby in the middle of the night.
Guess because he's older, Jessica. That's a lot harder when you're older. Yeah.
We are both older, yes.
Yes, and you too, of course.
So how do I, where do I find the energy and the motivation to yet motivate another person to become responsible for another person?
I think energy is sold down there by the lettuce, isn't it, Kathy?
Boy.
Is
yeah,
that where you can buy that energy? Yeah.
Amazon has it.
Amazon, yeah, just Google it.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah, it's tricky, especially if you're breastfeeding. The man can't do it in the night. You know, my husband was so great. He would get up in the night. The baby was on his side of the bed. He would pick her up. He would carry her around to my side of the bed, hand her to me. I would nurse her while he tried desperately to stay up. Then he would change her and put her back. And you know, I had stitches. I was recovering from a C-section, but eventually it just became silly. And I just did it. We moved her to my side of the bed because I was the one with the milk. So it's tricky, and I think that does set patterns. Most women nurse now, and the men can't do that. Most women are the ones, you know, in our country, maternity leave policies are not great, but paternity leave are worse. So the women are often, almost always, the ones home. So patterns start getting set where you're the one responding to the baby's cries, and it's tricky.
Yeah, it's very tricky. Do you think women put too much pressure on themselves to have it all, Kathy?
You know, I think that this is the one thing I kept coming back to. I think that a lot of women, you know, 71% of mothers today work, and many of them work full time, and it's not always optional. I mean, I grew up knowing I was going to work. I supported myself. I made half the family income at that time. So it wasn't like I was choosing to work, although I was choosing to work. But it wasn't like I had a choice, I guess. And that was the case with almost all my friends. We weren't, you know, wealthy stay-at-home mom types. We were working women who'd supported ourselves. So there's some – that's what part of what bothers me about having it all. I mean, you don't always have a choice. You just – you have to have your job, and you have to raise your children and feed them and take care of them, and you want to, but
in the process,
you know,
you have to give things up. And for our generation, I think I'm somewhat accurate here, that's really tough for a lot of people to do.
It's very tough. Yeah, and you do have to give things up. You have to. You can't, you know, one of the things my TED Talk is about, you can't be both your mother and your father. And so you have to figure out now, our generation has to figure out, which part of each are we each going to be, and what are we going to give up? And maybe that's, you know, home cooked dinners, or maybe that's having the perfect house. Or, but I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't feel like I was being a perfectionist. I just felt like I was struggling to get it all done. And I think if I could do it over, one thing I would do differently is try to have more help, even though we didn't have a lot of money at that time.
What kind of help? Yeah.
Like somebody to come in and do the groceries. If you don't have your mother there, I didn't have my mother there.
Yeah, we didn't either. Yeah.
So, you know, even though you're home, I mean, just having somebody come in a couple times a week for a couple of hours and hold the baby so you can go to bed, take a nap.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah. Isn't that the truth? Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're talking about parenting, relationships with Kathy Hauser here. Let's go to Tara here. Tara from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, this is Tara. Can you hear me?
You're on with Kathy Hanauer. Good morning.
Hi. I've never called into a radio show before, so
it's about time, Tara.
Kathy, I love that you're talking about this. I am a retired birth and postpartum doula, and I still teach childbirth education classes. But what I wanted to say was that what you're talking about has become so much of a focus on what I teach in classes, and many other people around the country and around the world are teaching, is really looking at the postpartum relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to let people know that there is something out there, that we're going beyond teaching about changing diapers or any of those kind of basic infant needs, but really looking at the relationship. I even have an activity that I do in my classes where I have couples go through a worksheet where they go through who is going to do what chore once baby comes. And
fantastic.
Then they compare.
Great idea.
They do it separately, and then they compare it, and then that opens a discussion of, well, who is going to unload the dishwasher?
I love
who
that.
Who is going to make the
That's
meals.
Exactly yeah. what I would design if I could do that.
Yeah.
In fact, I didn't know it was out there, but that would be so helpful because I think, you know, if you make a checklist, mom, dad,
right.
and you look at the checks, if they're not even and you're both working and both of
right.
your incomes are required, something's got to change. And that would just open the awareness and let it be somebody else doing it instead of the mother always having to nag and the father always having
yeah.
to feel he's not being valued. And
right.
Tara, I think that's such a good idea. I'm one of those guys that, you know, if I have that list in front of me, that works for me. If I'm being told sporadically during the course of a day when I'm doing other things, that doesn't work for me. So having that understanding going into the deal would have been helpful.
That's
absolutely.
So true.
And I think most of my students absolutely appreciate that afterwards.
No, I think
I love
that's
it.
Right.
You're so focused on the birth. You know, you're so focused on getting through that day. But that's just one day or maybe a
right.
few days. But it's a short period of time. And postpartum, especially that really intense period, can last anywhere from not just 6 weeks, but up to 3 years.
Hmm.
True.
You know, where you're adjusting and having this new life.
Right.
I mean, it's a new normal. And
yeah.
you have to learn. And being able to depend upon each other, but other individuals like postpartum doulas and friends and family and maybe church members that can come and bring meals, you know, whoever it may be, but learning that you can ask for help and that,
right.
you know, that idea that it takes a village. Yes, it takes a village and our villages are gone. So we have to make our villages.
Yeah.
So true.
Tara, I'm really
great.
Glad you called. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had
and
one
Steve,
of our, yeah, go
I
ahead.
I love that you can admit, like, I love what you just said, that guys, you'd be okay if you had a checklist, but
yeah.
you don't want her nagging you all day. Do this, do this. And I
yeah.
think that's sometimes the problem. Men end up defensive, and that their response to defensiveness is to just recede to the couch, you know?
Well, right. And in fairness to my wife, she shouldn't be the one who has to, shouldn't have had to have been the one to say, do this, do that. I should have been, you know, more often. I can see myself engaging more with what needs to happen. But I was pretty, I don't want to paint myself the wrong way. I was pretty engaged here. But still, I think the idea of a list makes a whole lot of sense here, you know. One of our callers had this observation, Kathy, after 25 years of marriage, I realize it's more of a struggle than a collaboration. Kathy, did you find other women who had that same realization that it's more of a struggle than all-out collaboration here?
In the early years or just in general?
I guess just in general, yeah.
I don't know. It's both. I mean, it depends on your marriage, of course. And one of the things I feel like worked for me is that I didn't get married till I was 30, and I knew by then what I wanted. And I married somebody who could make me laugh.
That helps.
And that I think that was our saving grace. You know, when things got really crazy with two little kids and two jobs, we could just look at it and say, oh, my God, you know, they both had dirty diapers. They were both crying at the same time. There was food all over the kitchen. And so that helps. I think, though, it is. It's an ongoing discussion when you have two jobs and two children, or even when probably when you have one job. I mean, whatever it is with children, you know, because I think that families where the woman is home and the man is working so hard to support the family, that's tricky in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you do have to keep talking about it. That's part of the solution, I think.
Kathy Hanauer is our guest. She's the New York Times bestselling author of The Bitch in the House and its companion newer volume, The Bitch is Back, Older, Wiser, and Getting Happier. We're talking about marriage, relationships, shared responsibilities here. She'll be in town Friday for TEDxKC. You know, your personal situation includes marriage, kids, and a career. And you say there are benefits for the children of a working mom, which are what?
I think my daughter sees that I've always worked, and that she should be expected to do the same. And she already is. She's a senior in college and has always worked. And you know, the satisfaction that comes from that, from being engaged with the world. My son sees that I'm not going to put a home-cooked dinner on the table every night. So he's learned to cook, and he's actually the best cook in our family at this point, partly because he cares the most about eating good food. but he, you know, I think it helps kids to grow up in a family where the mother works. They see they're more self-sufficient. I don't want to knock families that aren't like that, but what I see is that, you know, I stopped doing their laundry when they hit a certain age, and it makes them self-sufficient in certain ways, and also just see that the traditional roles are no longer really valid in this world in which, you know, 74 of 10 families today, the mother is the primary or sole earner.
Right.
So we've got to find different ways of doing it.
I wanted to get to this point in the minute we have left here. The second collection, The Bitch Is Back, had 9 of the original writers, and they look back on what they'd written for the first volume. How did time change their views on relationships, or did it always?
I think it did. I think, you know, you're just in a much different place when your kids are going off to college and you're facing them being gone. And I think some of them looked back, like Hope Edelman is the one I think about a lot, where she talked about, you know, she was so angry when the kids were young. Her husband was working so hard trying to do a startup. That was the dot-com era. And now she says, I realize I was making a million tiny little choices all along the way. Like, she didn't want her kids fully raised by somebody other than a parent, and her husband wasn't going to do it. He wasn't available. He couldn't. So she made the choice to cut back a little bit on her work as much as she could and be there for the kids while still working and still making an income. But, you know, it's just interesting to come at it back from a different perspective and not a place of anger. You appreciate it much more. And
women were generally happier.
Yes, I think the women my age, you know, once you hit your midlife, at least the women in this book, I mean, they knew, they figured out what they wanted. Many of them are writers. We think deeply. We go into therapy often. Mm-hmm. And we really try to figure out what we want. I mean, Kate Christensen, who was in both books, had left her marriage by the second book and married somebody else, a man who was 20 years younger. And she's much happier. She never did end up having kids. She feels good about that now. So she could look back on what, you know, what she wanted out of that first marriage and why she, in the second marriage, it's just better.
Right. Kathy Hanauer came to us courtesy of New England Public Radio. She'll be in town this Friday to speak at TEDxKC. The Kauffman Center event is sold out, but you can still view the event. Go to TEDxKC.org to find out how. Kathy, what a pleasure. We'll look forward to seeing you in Kansas City, okay?
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Pleasure to talk. Bye.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, a new perspective on criminal justice reform and an update on organized labor in Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.